Good morning and welcome to our talk on the SMAC stack. So maybe just a short question. Who already knows what SMAC stack is standing for, or the abbreviation? One hand. Even Kevin is raising his hand, where I was hoping he would know. So, okay, this is something which we're going to change here. So basically, this talk is about the intersection of microservices and fast data applications. So fast data applications referring to how can we do stream processing where we need really fast results in close to whatever real time means for us. I will be presenting, so I'm a distributed systems engineer at Mesosphere, which actually just translates to that I'm mostly working on the Apache Mesos open source project, and if I still have time, I like giving talks and educate other people about what you can actually do with this platform. And let's just go a step back in history and see how computing actually used to be. We used to have those very like big boxes, very monolithic. And actually, nowadays, data centers and computers more look like this. So this is a picture from an Azure data center in India, I believe. And it's way different. But what also changed, and this actually affects even more of us, is actually how the application layer changed. Applications on those first machines, they used to be very simple. So we used to have like our hardware layer, some operating system on top, and then there was our application running. So a very simple stack. Nowadays, it's actually slightly different as we are talking mostly about microservices. So microservices for me, the most defining term, there are so many different definitions of what microservices are, but the crucial point for me is actually that it's like small independent services, so we have to focus a lot more on the interfaces between them, but as we keep those interfaces stable, we can actually change them individually. And so this is what's here in like highlighted in bold, that it's actually, I can flexibly change the individual services, so I can replace one with another as long as I keep the interface stable. And on the other hand, I can actually also scale them individually. So before, in those old days when I had this one big monolithic application on top, I had to scale that application by duplicating it. So instead of running one of that, I immediately had to run two of that, even though the bottleneck might have just been the presentation layer to the users. And with microservices, as I have more individual services, I can actually also scale each of those services individually. What you should keep in mind is that doesn't just come by using microservices. This actually is an architectural decision for using microservices. So you should actually consider that already when developing your microservice architecture, your individual services, that they should be individually scalable and actually also individually failing. So meaning if there's one failing, it shouldn't necessarily take down the entire system. So, how does this picture now look with microservices? So with microservices, or also like in this today's world, it looks a little different. So often we just have an infrastructure underneath. Infrastructure can refer to either our own data center, it can refer to like Azure being like the cloud provider where I can run my services, where I can run my machines, and then I have some machines there. So in my own data center, these might be physical machines. On a cloud provider, these are usually, or most frequently, those are virtual machines running on top of the infrastructure here. Then, as before, I have some operating systems there, and then I actually have all my services running on top. And if I just want to do it as easily, I actually end up with a number of problems. So the most frequent problem, or the biggest problem, usually being the dependency hell. So dependency hell refers to this problem that each of the services, as they are very flexible and individual, they can actually all be written in different languages, and usually they also all have different dependencies. So there might be one application requiring Python 2, one requiring Python 3, or for example, different Java versions to run. So for that, we actually have to provide all those dependencies on all those individual operating systems. So before deploying a service, I would have to make sure on this operating system on the left, is actually, is there Python 2 available? Can I run it there? So this becomes very, very difficult. I end up with like a large spreadsheet, or some operators really has to keep track of what can run where. Fortunately, we can run everything in containers. Just a short question, who has used containers before here? Okay, yeah, some more hands, this is good. And so containers, they're a very useful concept for that. It actually has been around for a while, but especially in conjunction with microservices, it has become very, very popular. And for me, the two concepts or the two core ideas of containers are, first of all, I can stuff something into a container, and the container is actually going to provide all the dependencies. So I have my application plus all the dependencies it requires together in this container. The second thing what a container actually does, as you can see here on the ship, it isolates those different contents from one another. So I can actually run multiple containers on the same ship, so to speak, or on the same hardware, on the same machine in our world of computing, and they're actually isolated from each other. And how does that actually work? What, in its core, what containers are, so for example, what Docker actually is, they are different process groups running on like the same underlying kernel. And sorry for being here at mostly Microsoft-centric, but with those, we're actually most likely talking about Linux kernels. So even Microsoft, what they do, they will run like an Ubuntu virtual machine, because the two core Linux kernel features to enable containers are C groups and namespaces. C groups, on the one hand, is a concept which is used to isolate resources for different process groups. So I can, for example, say my container should use a maximum of 2 gigabytes of RAM. And then C groups, this kernel feature, will take care that this guarantee is actually that I can't use more. Namespaces, on the other hand, provide different views onto the underlying kernel. So for each of my process groups, for each of my containers, it looks like as if it would own the entire machine. So if we just, for example, talk about process IDs or host names, each of those containers can have its own host name, which can't be seen from another container. And therefore, it actually appears to each of them as if they would like own the machine or can configure anything they want on the machine. And just to symbolize that even more, if on like a Linux box, I simply run like a Docker image. So here I just choose like the Nginx image. And then I actually just look at all the processes running. I can see it from like the host operating system. So from that Linux box where I started that Docker container, I can actually see all the processes running inside that container, because actually it's just different process groups running on the same kernel. So the difference is just when I'm inside this process group, when I'm inside the container, I cannot see any other containers running there. But from like the host operating system, from the host, I can actually see all the container processes running there. And this is something which we should also keep in mind, that of course this gives us like a different isolation guarantee as, for example, compared to virtual machines, where I'm actually running its own operating system for each of the virtual machines. Okay, meanwhile, actually something else happens, and this was the trend towards like big data. So for me, Hadoop and MapReduce, they were like this first tool which actually enabled a lot of companies to do their own data processing. So all of a sudden, companies starting having their own Hadoop cluster, maybe like 5, 10, maybe even 20 machines somewhere in their basement to run their Hadoop cluster. Nowadays, unfortunately, we need to turn a little faster. So Hadoop, it used to be batch processing, so here on the left side, which was good if I had like a large amount of data, like several terabytes of data usually, and I just wanted to crunch all that data. There, I end up with response time somewhere in like hours to maybe even days. And if I actually, if I just do that like once a month, I don't care too much. But if I need something faster, usually hours is way too slow for me. So if I need something more interactive, the world then moved towards so-called micro-batching. So micro-batching, this is like typically when we talk about Spark use cases, when we do batch processing with Spark, where we end up with response time somewhere between minutes and seconds. And that actually already enables like totally different use cases for data analytics as compared to like this very slow batch processing on the left side. Still, even for some use cases, this isn't even fast enough. So for example, consider like credit card transactions. If I'm over here in Japan, I use my credit card, my bank is going to check and try to figure out, is this an okay transaction? Am I actually allowed to pay here with my credit card? Or have I in like the last 10 seconds used my card somewhere in Germany? So most likely when it's then being used here in Japan, this is probably fraud because I cannot travel as quickly from one country to the other. But those decisions, this is something where if they would take a second or even multiple seconds to decide, this would be way too slow. So there we have to be faster. So we need response time somewhere in microseconds. And this is when we actually talk about event processing. So as we can see, like there are many valid use cases for each of those categories. So there are still people running like traditional batch workloads. And there are actually a lot of people both running like micro batch workload and actually also like faster event processing workload. And so like a typical setup we see to run especially those event processing pipelines efficiently, we need a number of tools. It's not sufficient to simply have like the processing layer, but we have to build a pipeline around to make sure that we can actually also deliver the data as quickly as we need it to the tool, and that we can actually also store the results and react to the results as quickly as we need to. And this is where the term SMAC stack is actually coming from, because it's describing this typical pipeline. So on the left, we have like some events. This is, can be like sensor data. This can be like my credit card transaction, which I'm generating or starting to use. And then actually, I have some ingestion system. So you can imagine this just being like a big pipe or a big buffer, buffering all the credit card transactions and then forwarding them to the analytics layer. So it's basically just to load balance a bit and actually to be able to handle like spikes of very high workloads where maybe the analytics layer can't keep up with. The second part is then the actual analytics layer, and this is where we answer like all the questions we want to answer. As for example, is this credit card transaction valid or is it actually fraudulent? Then usually we have to store the results somewhere. And this can either mean we store the original data, or more often this means that we store the results of our analytics somewhere. And then, of course, storing is not sufficient. We also need something to react upon this and actually trigger some events, either display it to users or say this transaction has been fraudulent and therefore it's going to be declined. So we need some system acting up on whatever we just analyzed and stored in our databases. And as those are like many different tools, we need a layer underneath to enable us to deploy that all on like a cluster. And this is where actually Mesos is coming in, which we're going to see more about in 1 second. And so just to reveal now what SMAC stack actually stands for. So the S actually stands for Apache Spark. The M is then the Apache Mesos reference as the cluster manager. The A stands for ACA, which is like a common tool set to write those actors reacting up on the data. The C actually stands for the storage layer for Apache Cassandra. Then the K is actually Apache Kafka being like the ingestion and message queue up front. And what does it actually mean for our data center, which we saw like this nice modern data center here? And if we take this naive approach, which we still see a lot of users doing, they take like the first 5 machines either in their physical data center or maybe also like on Azure. And on those first five nodes, they're gonna install Spark. Maybe they will install Flink as like their analytics layer. Then they will take another set of 3 to 4 nodes where they will install like their Kafka cluster. They will take another node to install like their storage layer, which could be Cassandra in this case. Maybe they even have some traditional like big MySQL, or as we hear at Microsoft, MSQL database running in their cluster as well. So they need another machine for that. And then they actually also have all those microservices running there, which we saw earlier. So they will take another subpart of that cluster with maybe 10 instances to run their microservice workload on that. And this effectively means they sub-partition their cluster into many smaller clusters. In this image, we have like a small Spark cluster, we have a Kafka cluster, we have a MySQL cluster, microservice cluster, Cassandra cluster. And this actually is from an operational point. So whenever you talk to like your operations department, they will hate you for this because it's very, very hard to maintain. Just imagine that there's a node failure in your microservice cluster, where often you're running user-facing applications, then often like a operator has to come in and provision like a new virtual machine or assign another physical machine to the subpart of the cluster. So it's very, very difficult to operate such kind of sub-partition cluster. And the second problem is actually then the utilization rate. So as each of those subclusters I have to provision for the maximum workload, I usually end up with very bad utilization rates, somewhere between 12 and 15%. So I'm wasting a lot of resources and often like a lot of money as well. And if we are not actually operating Azure ourselves and we want people to use as much of Azure resources as possible, this is something which we as users would like to avoid because we want to be efficient with the resources and with the money we spend on our infrastructure. And actually, Twitter in its early years, I don't know who remembers like this Twitter fail whale whenever Twitter wasn't working correctly because they couldn't provision or they simply were really hitting like their load limits. They actually had similar problems with their cluster, and they actually came up with an open source project called Apache Mesos. So it was originally developed at UC Berkeley over in US. And so when they heard of it, they actually liked the idea, which is mainly actually treating your data center as if it would be a single computer. So if we take that analogy, for example, looking at my laptop actually has multiple CPUs, but I don't care which CPU is currently used to present here my slides. I don't care which CPU is being used to later on show my demo. I simply want to say, run my web browser, run my slides, but I don't really care which underlying resources are used for that. And actually, Mesos and thereby also DCOS give you a similar abstraction for your data center, where you simply say, run 5 instances of Spark on my cluster, run 10 containers of like Nginx as being a web server on my cluster. And then the system is actually responsible for keeping that up and running. So for example, if one of those nodes is failing, it'll just try to reschedule it somewhere else. And hence actually just treating your data center as like one big resource where you can say run job, run application on this particular resource. And so nowadays, actually, Apache Mesos, it's a top-level Apache project, so anyone can also contribute. And it's being used by a lot of large companies. So for example, Twitter, as mentioned earlier, Airbnb, PayPal, Apple uses it, Netflix uses it, and they often use it on very large clusters with several 10,000 nodes, which, especially for me, being a Mesos developer myself, is really... It's nice on the one hand because I see that my work is being used on very and tested as well on very large clusters. On the other hand, it's sometimes we are very conservative with what kind of code gets merged in because we have to be careful not to break the Twitter cluster, not to break the Apple cluster. So it's good and bad at the same time. So, and actually Mesos has also like native Docker support, so we can actually run all those containers we've been talking about before quite efficiently. What makes Mesos so flexible and so usable for not only running those container workloads, but basically also for running this fast data stack we've been talking about, for running Kafka, Cassandra, and all those other tools on top. And this is the concept of two-level scheduling. So if we look at two-level scheduling, this actually means Mesos itself doesn't really care about application-specific scheduling. This is being outsourced to schedulers running on top. So Mesos itself is basically just a resource abstraction. And on top, we can then have application-specific schedulers. And those, these are really easy to write because they don't require much code. They can simply code against the Mesos interface. And hence, I can quickly spin up those application-specific logic. And what's important here to understand is that the requirements for a container scheduler, where I want to say run 10 instances of that containers, are quite different from the requirements, for example, for an HDFS scheduler. So HDFS, this is like the file system, the distributed file system, being heavily used in like the Hadoop MapReduce space. And there, of course, we have way different failure scenarios, so which the scheduler has to take care of. Imagine, for example, if you're a little familiar with HDFS, that both of the name nodes fail. So the name nodes, they are like the central nodes keeping all the metadata in for that file system. And if both of those nodes fails, we actually we have a way to regain that data and restart the name nodes. But we actually, the scheduler has to do that some manual work of restarting those name nodes. And this is all logic which we can code into such kind of scheduler, but you already see this is quite application specific, as it's going to be different for a Spark scheduler, it will be different for an HDFS scheduler, and hence we can actually outsource all this application specific data into like the small schedulers. And DCOS. So DCOS actually stands for Data Center Operating System, and I would call it like a distribution of Apache Mesos. As you have seen before, there are like a lot of large companies using Mesos, and all of those companies, they actually have like some larger engineering teams which can actually figure out a lot of the problems, such, for example, which schedulers to run on top, how to do service discovery, how to monitor that entire stack running there, how to create a UI, and so on and so on. But for many smaller companies, and actually also for many larger companies, they don't want to invest that effort. They simply want to run something. And this is kind of the idea of the DCOS, so the Data Center Operating System, being the distribution which actually is built around Apache Mesos, but it gives you more. It gives you like the schedulers for container orchestration. It gives you like security, monitoring, user interface. So it gives you like everything you actually need to run it in production. And running DCOS in production, this actually then enables you to both be flexible on top, so you can run your microservices, all your container workloads, and you can also run like all your big data stack, Hadoop, Flink, and do all this cool stuff we saw when doing like this SmackStack style of processing. It also, on the other hand, gives you flexibility to the underlying layer. So you're actually independent on what infrastructure you run. So all of a sudden, it doesn't matter anymore whether you build your application stack on Azure directly or whether you build it first in your on-prem data center, switch over to Azure, or maybe vice versa if you're trying to build up your on-prem data center, because DCOS, hence Mesos, actually gives you this abstraction for the underlying hardware. DCOS itself, it's completely open source. You can just go to DCOS.io, download installers for all major cloud vendors, or templates for all major cloud vendors, installers for your on-prem data center, and simply run it. Anyone can also contribute to it. So this is also like very nice because a lot of people and a lot of different companies are actually contributing to this. If you're running on Azure itself, you have multiple options of actually obtaining it. So first there's the Azure Marketplace, where currently, as of this morning, it's still the old version, but within like the next 1 or 2 days, you should also have like the newer 1.9 version available there. And so this is simply like a one-click of spinning up your cluster. And then there are also like the ARM templates, if you're a little familiar with Azure, where you can simply go in and deploy it like your own cluster also on Azure. I would say if you're like a first-time starter, I would recommend you to use the Marketplace, because it basically it has defaults for all settings. If you're a little more advanced and you actually maybe have started your first cluster, then you can also take a look at the ARM templates, where you're exposed with some more options which actually allow you to configure your cluster to, yeah, a more deeper level of granularity. And yeah, let's just come back to the SMAC stack actually and take a little deeper look what it actually means running that. So for me, SMAC stack, as mentioned, is actually it's more about this pipeline. So for me, SMAC stack doesn't really stand for those individual tools, Spark, Cassandra, Kafka. It actually stands for this idea of separating ingestion, storage, analytics, and then acting up on it. And so if we just dive into the first part, which is actually the ingestion or message queues, we already see we have more options than just Apache Kafka. We can run something like RabbitMQ, we can run Disk. If we are just caring about logging, we can run Fluidd, Logstash, and there are like even more tools. So if we are running in cloud environments, most cloud providers, they also have their own solutions for that. Maybe this is the only thing you should keep in mind. If you're actually running, for example, on Azure and you try to use the Azure-specific message queues, this actually would tie you again to Azure. So switching over to your on-prem data center would be, again, a little harder. Sorry to the Azure folks in here. It's still cool to run it on Azure. Just with the tools I actually use in my architecture, I would try to stay open source because it actually allows me to switch over to other vendors or to my on-prem data center, maybe even like a hybrid setup later on in my development of the company. The most commonly used one is Apache Kafka. So it's actually originally, it's an open source project developed by LinkedIn. And I usually like to describe it as like a fire hose. So Kafka is really nice if you simply want to move large data sets, large amounts of events from a number of producers to a number of consumers on the other side. So I always like to imagine Kafka as being like a named pipe. So in Kafka, I can create like many named pipes. They're called topics. So I can, for example, create a topic, Events Asia, where I can then have producers throwing all data in, and I can have consumers on the other side consuming that data later on. And the central idea and the central benefactor in this kind of architecture is that I can actually buffer between those services. So imagine, for example, I have some very bursty producers. One example could, for example, be planes landing. So planes collecting a lot of sensor data while they're in the air. Once they land on the ground, there's a huge, they pluck out that hard disk and throw in like all the events collected during that flight into the system. So at one point in time, we will have a lot of events flowing into our system. And actually, our consumers might be overloaded. So if we would directly pipe that to the consumers, they would be overloaded. And this is why it's really beneficial to have this abstraction layer in between, which can buffer and which can also help us to load balance between different consumers on the other side. One thing you should keep in mind when dealing with all message queues, so this actually holds true for all the systems mentioned here to more or less degrees, are the delivery guarantees. So if I'm talking about such kind of system, what I would usually expect, a producer writes a message into this named pipe and then it's actually consumed exactly once on the other end. So one consumer will receive one event. Unfortunately, we're talking about distributed systems here, so it's really, really hard to achieve this exactly once guarantee that one event is delivered exactly once to the consumers on the other side, because there might be failures. So usually, if there are no failures in the system, all nodes keep running, network is stable, everything is great, we can actually achieve exactly once guarantees. But as soon as we end up having failures, nodes failing, network failing, it's most likely going to degenerate into either one of those options. And this is actually something where message queues vary. And this is something you should also keep in mind when developing your own architecture around it, because it will affect your architecture, or your architecture, your applications have to deal with that. And so the one is actually at most once, which means the message might be dropped, so might be not delivered at all, or it might actually be delivered exactly once. So in that case, your application actually has to deal with missing messages, and it can't rely on that every message will be delivered. The other system, or the other concept, which is actually followed by Apache Kafka, it's called at least once. So the system will guarantee that an event will be delivered to the consumer, but it might also happen that it's being delivered multiple times. So this is also something your application would have to deal with, and be able to handle that the event might end up like multiple times at a consumer side here. So let's that was sufficient for like a short introduction to message queues. Let's actually flip over to the analytics layer, and hence Apache Spark mostly. If we talk about stream processing, we even have more options than for message queues. And in the recent years, they have been more and more either being developed or actually being open sourced, which had been around for quite a while in like proprietary settings. And so the most common ones, which I see most commonly, are actually Apache Storm, which is a little older system, Apache Spark, and Apache Flink. Being used, but also like Apex or Concord are used by some people. Again, we have some cloud-specific ones. Again, I would recommend to stick with the open source versions, as they give you more flexibility of changing the underlying infrastructure. Spark is the most commonly used one, and this mostly resides from the fact that a lot of people already use it for other use cases, for this microbatch use case we saw on like the earlier slides. So Spark not only allows you to do stream processing, Spark actually allows you to do batch processing. They have like machine learning libraries on top, they have graph processing on top. So it's actually like a quite large toolbox to run stuff on top. And for streaming, they actually do something clever. They do microbatching. So as Spark is actually, it's a batch system. So what they do, if they want to do stream processing, they collect a very small amount of events. So they might, for example, collect 5 events. And as soon as they have collected 5 events, they will process those 5 events in a microbatch. And this actually is very useful on the one hand, because I can use the same code, the same jobs I use for my batch processing, I can use for my stream processing. I don't have to rewrite anything, I just plug it over to the stream interface. On the other hand, this of course adds latency. So if we need something which has latencies in this microsecond range, probably this isn't like the best use case. Still, what you should keep in mind for this is that the boundaries, it's quite flowing. A lot, if you talk to users or customers, a lot of them will say, yes, of course I need microsecond response times, of course I need real time, whatever real time means for them. But actually, if you discuss with them further, it'll turn out that like a second response time, or even half a second, which you can achieve with Spark, is sufficient. And so I believe it depends on your actual use case, what makes more sense. And for many use cases, I believe Spark streaming is actually sufficient. If I need something more responsive, if I actually check my requirements and I say, this micro-batching doesn't work for me because it's too slow, then I actually need to turn to something native streaming, which would process each event individually. And this is, for example, what Storm, Flink, or Apache Apex can do. Now, I would actually like to show you a short demo of how that all comes together. And this is a demo which is based upon like a real use case by a customer of our or user of DCOS, and they're called S3. So S3, they do like geospatial processing, and the typical pipeline we see here, it's almost the smack stack we've been talking about. On the left, we got some event source generating or simulating our sensor data. And then we have Apache Kafka as the ingestion queue. We got S3 for the analytics layer. Elasticsearch, this is where we diverge from the SMAC stack as a storage layer. So we don't use Cassandra here, but Elasticsearch instead. And then we actually have some JavaScript application nicely showing that for us. And the use case, what we're going to do here is actually we will track taxis across New York City and be able to see how many taxis are in which area, which then, where we unfortunately don't have time for, can be used to schedule where do we need more taxis, where do we have to redirect taxis to. And for doing that, I'll just switch to my browser and hope it's stable. So here again, this is a marketplace you can use to spin up a cluster. And this is actually the first thing you see when you log into one of those clusters. So this dashboard, and what I like about this dashboard, actually, it's a focus. So it will show you actually like your CPU allocation, your memory allocation, so how much of your resources is being used. And being an operator, this is what I most likely will care about. Like, first, when I scroll down, I see actually, oh, there are 15 nodes backing this cluster, but this is not the most crucial part. I, as an operator, I don't want to be woken up at night simply because one node failed. I want to be woken up if my resource allocation is at somewhere like 99%, meaning I can't run anything anymore on my cluster. So now the nice part is actually that we have packages. So this is similar as like an app store for your cluster. And this is also where like a lot of open source contributions come in, contributing those individual packages. So I can go here and I can actually install Kafka with like a single click. So now if we switch back to the dashboard, we actually see like our CPU allocation is going up, memory allocation is going up, and something is actually being deployed on the cluster. So, okay, this is the first part. We actually can also install it differently. And this is by using the CLI. So the CLI actually allows me to control the cluster from my own command line. Because in production use cases, I don't want to click somewhere in some UI. I want to have like some scripted pipeline which allows me to deploy something. So I could have also installed Kafka from here. So DCOS package install Kafka would have been the equivalent to what we just did in that interface. And what we can also do, we can actually have like our own deployment files. So here in this directory, I have like a number of JSON files, which I will now deploy to the cluster and then also show you what it's actually about. And let's start with the Elasticsearch one. So DCOS Marathon app add Elasticsearch. Okay, so we have our first deployment. And as we're already here, I simply will deploy all the other tools as well. So the next one, this is actually our Spark jobs. And for S3, they are called RAT. So RAT standing for real-time analytic tasks. So let's deploy those. RAT1.json. And then last but not least, what we actually need is our data generator. As our data generator will write into Kafka, we actually need to do something first. We have to create this named pipe where we can write data into. And this we can actually do from the UI here as well. because Kafka is integrated into it. So DCS Kafka, topic, create. And as we are dealing with taxis, we're simply gonna call this pipe taxi. This might take a while. I hope Kafka was already deployed. Yes. So we can actually just list also now the different topics. And hopefully, yeah, we have our taxi pipe here. So our data generator can actually write data into here. And this allows us now to deploy like our data generator. So it's simulating like all this taxi data where they are currently in New York City. Source 1.json. Oh. App, I forgot the add. So this is also being deployed. And now the last part which we actually would need is the GUI later on. So I also simply gonna deploy this. S3 GUI, here we go. And while this is deploying in the background, we can have, take a short look at our cluster. So we see like resource utilization is going up, memory allocation is going up because now we're actually utilizing the cluster and deploying stuff on the cluster. But let's take one short look at those configuration files so we actually see what we deployed. So if we look at this, it's a very simple JSON format. And the central part is actually here, like our container definition, which says use the Mesosphere Spark image to run on those nodes. And in there, we can then actually deploy our analytic task, so our Spark job for running it. So as you can see, this is a very simple format. And if I'm running something in production, I will deploy those JSON files because this is something I can keep versioned in some kind of GitHub repository or in some other Artifactory, and I can always make sure what's currently running in the cluster. Okay. And let's switch back to our cluster and see how it's deploying. So that looks good. If we look at services, we already see Elasticsearch is running. And this is something else which is quite nice. So I can actually, if I'm a scheduler as the Elasticsearch scheduler, I can actually go in here and I can say, so currently I have 5 nodes here, and maybe as we are now using a lot of data, this is too little and we actually need to scale. So I can go in here and add 1 more node to my cluster. And as we now see, 6 nodes, and if we switch over to the UI, we also see you have now here another staging task, and we might see, but I guess we were too slow, also see here a small increase. So actually as a scheduler, I can also individually scale up and scale down depending on like how many resources I need right now. So this is nice. Let's see whether our GUI is already deployed. The GUI is already deployed, so something is loading. It's loading for the first time. It's simply like we probably have to wait for another minute to see all the taxi data being deployed because they are currently just going through the pipeline. So first the data generator has to generate events, and it takes a while until our GUI is picking it up, but we can already see New York, so this is good. As we are waiting for that, I would briefly switch back to the presentation and just finish the presentation, and then we'll move back to the demo and hopefully see taxis driving across New York City. So we now just deployed the SMAC stack, but what I always find quite crucial is that this is the easy part. This is just, we deployed a demo which is running very nice, we can show something, but the actual hard part is about to keep it running. So this is something we usually like to reference as day 2 operations, and this is actually day 2 referencing this term. Day 0, this is, we just deployed our application, everyone is happy because it's green and running, but latest on day 1, someone is going to come and ask, oh, I need a newer version of this application. I need to actually upgrade DCOS on the cluster itself. So we have to maintain our application and keep it running for multiple days, which is way different from just deploying it for the first time. And so this is something you should keep in mind when doing when also designing the system. And the first challenge usually is configuration updates. So configuration updates, what happens if I need to deploy a new version of, first of all, my application itself? If I need to deploy a new version of Cassandra, for example, how can I do that without affecting users? Because especially with those interactive systems, I want to be able to have rolling upgrades or blue-green deployments or canary deployments, which I can deploy, test my application without affecting users, so the users can actually keep on using the system. Secondly, is also cluster maintenance. So what happens if I actually need to upgrade DCOS itself? A nice feature there is, and this is something I personally didn't like about Docker for a long time. Whenever I would need to upgrade Docker, I had to take down all containers on the same node. With Mesos and DCOS, you can go in, upgrade the system, and your applications running on top as Cassandra, they will keep on running while you're upgrading the system. What you should also consider for each production-ready cluster is monitoring. How can you monitor the system? How can you make sure it's online, it's available? What endpoints do you want to monitor? Resource consumption, and so on. And also, it will happen in any production system, is how can you effectively debug runtime blockages? How can you enable developers to debug their own containers? Do you have to give them SSH access to the cluster because they need to do Docker exec? Or is there another way which, for example, like DCOS allows you to really give fine-grained access control to which containers you want to debug and which containers, who is allowed to debug which container running on top of it? So those are all considerations you should keep in mind when running stuff or when designing such kind of system. Now let's briefly switch back and reload, and hopefully we see our taxi. So our pipeline was sufficient. We see here some heat maps. So there are a lot of taxis in central Manhattan. And if we scroll in further, we should actually at some point be able to see individual taxis here. So this actually means we effectively deployed our pipeline, and now it's producing data, and our app can actually pick it up from Elasticsearch and display it here. In terms of time, but I think works out perfectly. So this is my last slide. Thank you very much for listening. I should briefly switch over to the other screen here, but if you care, you can actually follow DCOS, and there's also like a Slack channel where you can ask a lot of questions. And otherwise, just go to DCOS.io. It's all open source there. Download the installers, try it out on Azure or other cloud vendors if you prefer, and just play with it. If you have questions, go to Slack channel, write to the mailing list, or just approach any of us via various media. So this brings me back to this screen, which is the number? One? Okay, I'm not seeing the slide, I would hope to. But the TLDRs, actually there's a short feedback for those slides. Oh, thank you. So just go here. I can't really read what's on the slide, but just go here, fill it out if you have more questions. And I will actually also be here as the speaker's room, so I will be there afterwards. So if you have more questions, just drop by there. Feel free to ask. I can also show more demos and show you what you can actually do with the systems. Thank you very much for listening.